For 30 years, Irene Pepperberg worked closely with a colleague on the question of animal intelligence. When the two began, most thought the question itself was ridiculous. I mean, animals couldn't think.
But Dr. Pepperberg suspected otherwise, based on research breakthroughs with chimpanzees. So she persisted, and her colleagues supported her, from the tip of his pointed beak to the end of his red-feathered tail.
Together, Alex, an African gray parrot, and Irene Pepperberg changed our ideas about animal intelligence. Alex learned lots of words and concepts. He could identify the material of objects, or what matter, and their shape, for example, a square piece of wool.
Alex, what matter?
Wool.
That's right. How many corners? What shape?
Four. Corner.
Four corner, good boy.
Or how many of a particular kind of object were on a tray of diverse objects.
Hey, look, can you tell me? On the tray, how many green block? How many green block?
Two.
Good parrot, two green block, two. Good.
And in his squeaky voice, let his owner know he was thirsty.
You want some water?
All right.
Irene Pepperberg's work with Alex showed that a parrot, a bird, could demonstrate basic reasoning and communicate with humans. It was breakthrough research. But when she began, and for years into her work, Dr. Pepperberg fought for support, funding, and otherwise.
So many people years ago looked at my first grant proposal, and the reviews came back essentially asking me what I was smoking. Because nobody believed that a bird with a brain the size of a shelled walnut could do any of this.
They believe it today. Alex demonstrated that he could count, reason, and express his wants, and that the separation between the cognitive abilities of humans and other animals was not the vast gulf we once imagined. Since then, a number of studies have supported Dr. Pepperberg's claims of avian intelligence.
Sadly, Alex is no longer with us. He died suddenly in September 2007. His passing made headlines all over the world. Within a few days of his death, Dr. Pepperberg received more than 6,000 condolences via email alone.
This outpouring removed any doubt as to whether her work with Alex had an impact, and that prompted her to write her own tribute to her feathered friend. Alex and Me is the title of her book, How a Scientist and a Parrot Uncovered a Hidden World of Animal Intelligence and Formed a Deep Bond in the Process.
And it all began when she went shopping for a parrot in 1977. Her criterion was to find a bird that was not imported from Africa, out of a concern for smuggling. She finally found a store that had bred African gray parrots domestically.
So we finally found a store that was selling birds that had been bred domestically. When we went into the store, there was a cage of 8 or 9 gray parrots. And I asked the fellow who was working there to pick one, just, you know, randomly, so that nobody could argue that there was something special about Alex.
So what happened? He picked...
So he, you know, took a big butterfly net, scooped up a bird, flipped him on his back, clipped his beak, his toes, and his wings, and said, here, $600. And, you know, that was our first interaction.
Now, when you took him home, he was nervous at first, and it took a while to gain his trust.
Oh, yeah. I mean, think about an animal who'd been living in this cage, and maybe happy, maybe not, who knows, but, you know, had a certain life for at least 6 months, and then gets literally manhandled, stuffed in a dark box, driven for 3.5 hours in this dark box, and then comes out, and there's this small room with a cage and two humans looking at him, and he's looking at them. Wasn't the nicest way to introduce the bird to us, but that's the way it had to be.
Now, you began to train him, and at that time, there was a psychological model known as behaviorism, which was operating with regard to animals, which treated them as automatons. What was that model?
Well, it's interesting. It's not just animals, but people looked at other people that way. The idea was that all your behavior was determined by reward and punishment. So if one rewarded a behavior, it would be done more to get more reward. And if you absolutely punish somebody for doing something, then that behavior would extinguish or disappear because people would not, and animals and any individual would not want that punishment. So this was the idea. Unfortunately, it's not the only way that individuals learn.
And the level of intelligence was in question. Is that
the idea was? Because the idea was that thinking wasn't something we worried about, even in humans. It was just a matter of rewards and punishments. And animals were supposed to be, you know, somewhat more primitive. But again, they would work with the same principles of reward and punishment. And thinking was not something that humans in this area cared to examine, whether it was in humans or in animals. Animals were, you know, not very smart, particularly birds didn't have, people didn't think that birds had a cortex, the so-called area of intelligence that we see in primates and also in other mammals. And it turns out, of course, nowadays we know that there is a cortical-like area. It is in different sizes relative to the rest of the brain, depending on the avian species you're looking at. So if you look at the parrots and the crows and the jays, this area is relatively huge. It's about the same proportion of the brain as true in the apes. So what I intended to do really had good bases, but we didn't know that then.
Now, you taught Alex to communicate, and when he first learned to communicate, he tried to say the word paper, but he couldn't say P. Why couldn't he say P?
Well, think about trying to say paper without lips.
He had no lips.
He had no lips, and it turned out eventually he learned to use his esophagus, the way people who have cancer and have laryngectomies learn to sort of burp their P's and B's. And that's what he seemed to do.
So what did he say? What did it sound like?
The first thing was going, air, which was fine because it was consistent. And as long as it was a consistent label, I mean, there was no particular reason why it had to be English paper as long as it was consistent.
He ended up learning over 100 words?
100 different labels for objects. If you consider things like green key and green paper, two separate labels, and different from red key, red paper. There are about 50 object labels. There are also some labels for foods. He learned 7 colors, 5 shapes, quantities up to including 6, and at the end we got 7 and 8. He understood concepts of bigger and smaller, of same and different, of absence, of category, and he combined all those labels, and that's where you got the 100 different objects that he could identify.
Well, give me an example of something that he could identify. So if you showed him a green block, what would he say?
Well, you showed him and you'd say, you know, what color? And he'd say green. And what shape? And he'd say four corner. And what matter? Likely wood. And what toy? He'd say block. So he could answer all these different questions about the object. And that was very important because it meant that it wasn't a simple, you know, here's a stimulus and give me a response. But here's a stimulus. Here's a particular question about the stimulus. Process that question, determine which set of answers were appropriate, and then determine the correct answer from that set.
So you were able to rule out that he wasn't just mimicking, and this is what many people said to you, that the parrots, they mimic, they have this terrific ability to do so, and that's what Alex was doing, but you say no.
No, it was clearly not that, because of this ability to answer all these different questions, depending on what I asked him. And what was important, of course, was this imitative ability to produce the sounds of English speech. But then it was the idea that he was able to actually map the meaning. We call this referential mapping, to map the meaning of these labels and to understand what they meant and to use them appropriately.
And then one of the things, as you said, he could do is he could compare objects and say which one was bigger and which one was smaller. In that case, you would show him 2 different objects, and what would he say?
Well, we'd show him the objects and say, what color bigger or what color smaller, or what matter bigger or what matter smaller, and he tells the appropriate color or material label.
So what does this suggest about Alex's cognitive ability, and where can you put him if you compare his level of ability with a human, which is really what we're doing here? So like,
well,
a toddler? Or?
On the types of tasks that he could do, he was about the level of a 5 or 6-year-old child. Now, he obviously couldn't do all the kinds of things that children could do. We really weren't teaching him to read. We weren't teaching him a lot of the things that 5 or 6-year-old children are taught. But on things like our number studies, on some of our comprehension tasks, he was at the level of this 5 or 6-year-old child.
How do you feel when people ask, how do you compare him with a human?
It's hard, because this is not an animal that has been brought up exactly the way a human child was brought up.
And he's not human, but that's always our reference point, isn't it?
Well, yeah, we're very human-centric because that's what we understand. I mean, when you want to think about something, the easiest thing to think about it is in terms of what you already know. It's easier to compare him to chimpanzees or to dolphins because we literally replicated the same studies that were done with chimpanzees and dolphins. And I could say, yes, you know, everything that the apes have done, you know, in the animal-human communication studies, everything the dolphins have done, we've pretty much done the same tasks that Alex did as well as those animals.
You were less interested in teaching him language than what language revealed about his mind. What did it reveal in the end?
Well, I don't even like to call it language. I call it a two-way communication code because that's what it was. And it revealed that he had abilities that nobody believed a non-human would have. Nobody believed a non-primate would have. Nobody believed a non-mammalian animal would have. And yet he performed at the same level as these apes and these marine mammals. And it shows that intelligence is spread across the whole area, the whole different species, that different animals have different niches and have exploited those niches. People ask me, well, how does he compare with a tool-using crow, tool-making crow? People ask me, how is he compared to the tool-making crow? And I said, well, a parrot has a Swiss Army knife on front of its face and its beak. It doesn't need to make many tools because it has the Gordian knot approach to these things. You just crack things apart. So certain comparisons are very difficult to make simply because of the physiology of the animal and the anatomy. And these are, you know, again, very interesting ways of looking at animals, but they are very, very smart in ways that humans just didn't expect.
You had an emotional connection with Alex that perhaps goes without saying. I wonder what insight you have into his emotional life, because he did respond to you on an emotional level, if I can say that. I'm being cautious about that. The case that comes to mind, if you could just tell the story briefly, was when he told you to calm down.
Oh, yes. It's not clear exactly what is going on in a situation like that. How much of it is he knows a certain response to make in a certain situation, so that when he would be agitated, we would tell him to calm down, and then he sees me acting this way, which is not something that he appreciates because I'm the flock leader, and if there's something wrong with the flock leader, it's not good for the whole flock.
Well, what were you doing? You were upset about something.
Well, I was upset about, I can't even remember exactly, but there was something at a faculty meeting that had annoyed me, and I was stomping down the hall, you know, on the way to the lab, and stomped into the room and didn't greet him appropriately, and just was, you know, heading for my office. Clomp, 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 and it's just, you know, calm down, because that was, you know, he knew that was an appropriate thing to say, contextually appropriate thing to say. And he definitely had emotions. I'm not going to deny that. They were there. You could tell the difference between when, you know, one of the students was popping his quills and his whole body was relaxed and it was like he was getting a, you know, full body massage, or the times when he was being aggressive because somebody was doing something he didn't want them to do and his whole body was, you know, feathers puffed up and eyes flashing. We had a photographer who was strobing us once instead of doing background lighting, and he was absolutely furious, and you could see this. These are behaviors. These are emotions. They're there. It's just difficult to put a human label, because even with humans, we don't know exactly what we are labeling when we label another person's behavior.
Alex died suddenly in September 2007. He was 31 years old. Can you explain what happened the night before and the day that he died?
The night before was just a same night as ever. I mean, we were cleaning up the lab. We had a little good night routine that we set every night. It's not clear that any of these labels and things had meaning, but it was a routine. You know, it was. And people asked me so many times, what were the exact last words? But it was a fluid little situation. So sometimes I'd say something, sometimes he'd say something, but the general gist was, you know, I'm going to go eat dinner. That's right. I'm going to go eat dinner. I'll see you tomorrow. I'll be in tomorrow. I love you. I love you too. And we'd both go back and forth in this, and this was a good night routine. And this signified to Alex and to the other birds in the lab that this was the end of the day, and then it was a normal ending to the day, and I wasn't leaving because of a timeout because they didn't want to work or something like that. And so we engaged in that, and it was, you know, you be good, I love you, I'll see you tomorrow, yep, I'll be in tomorrow, and walked out the door, and there was nothing that would have suggested that this was any night other than the usual night.
How did he die? Do you know?
It was a heart arrhythmia.
Is 31 an old age, a middle age for a parrot?
It's middle aged. It was amazing. He had been at the vet the week before, full checkup. You know, everything was fine. My vet basically said it's sort of like the middle aged fellow who's in the doctor's office, gets his checkup. The doctor says, "You're great," pats him on the shoulder. You know, "You'll live for another 30 years." And the guy walks out the door and has a heart attack that didn't show up on any possible tests that could be given.
There was an outpouring of grief for Alex. I mean, certainly you experienced your own, but around the world, it was really tremendous. And the political and business magazine, The Economist, which doesn't usually cover this sort of thing, devoted a whole page to Alex. And the reporter wrote that by the end of his life, Alex had the intelligence of a five-year-old and had not realized his full potential. What was Alex's potential?
Well, we don't really know because we couldn't exploit it, but we had just started some work on optical illusions. How literally do these birds see the world? Because their eyes are on opposite sides of their heads, monocular vision to some extent. There's not too much binocular overlap the way we have with our eyes front forward. So we started on a series of studies on optical illusions, thinking that do they get faked by the optical illusions the way we do, and that would help us learn something about their visual system. So that was something we're doing. We're going to be doing some more work on number theories. Just before he died, there was evidence that he really understood numbers at the same level as young children, exact numbers, exact number representations, which was really important. And we wanted to continue on with that kind of work.
To what extent is this work continuing with Griffin and some of the other birds?
Well, we're training Griffin now on his colors and shapes. Griffin knows about 12 different objects and food labels. And so now we're working on the colors and shapes with him. Hopefully we can work on the optical illusion studies once he gets that down pat.
Thank you very much for talking to us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Irene Pepperberg teaches animal cognition at Harvard University. Her book is Alex and Me, How a Scientist and a Parrot Uncovered a Hidden World of Animal Intelligence and Formed a Deep Bond in the Process. Coming up, meet another member of the Brainy Bunch. No feathers this time, or even a vertebra, but 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 arms. It's Are We Alone?
Are you smart enough to be a Team SETI member? I mean, can your cerebellum handle it? Okay, because by becoming a Team SETI member, you support the work of the scientists at the SETI Institute who are looking for intelligent life elsewhere in the cosmos. But then you knew that, right? And you're undoubtedly also cognitively aware that you can just go to the website SETI.org to join Team SETI, and that if you send an email to the radio show at arewealone@SETI.org, that's arewealone@SETI.org, we'll send you a glossy photo of the brainiest bunch ever to pose inside our studio at 3:30 p.m. on a Tuesday. Perfect for your family photo album or for exercising that new office shredder. Just go to the website SETI.org and make your gray matter happy. What has 8 arms, is slippery, and can instantly blend into its surroundings?
4 piano players in duck fat wearing camouflage outfits?
That's really close, Seth. No, actually, it's not close at all. The answer is cuttlefish.
Oh.
Which are actually not fish.
Nope, they're mollusks that belong to the cephalopoda class that also includes octopuses and squids.
Now, I always thought octopuses, the plural would just be octopus.
Yeah, maybe you thought it was octopi.
No, I wasn't sure, although we had that for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, serves 8.
Our last common ancestor with a cephalopod was likely to be a worm-like creature.
Of course. We've moved on since then. Humans developed vertebrae, bipedalism, hairy underarms, and big brains. All right, big brains. Now, does that mean we've cornered the market on intelligence?
Get your massive cerebellums here and only here, folks. We got gray matter to go. Best medullas on the market. 2 for 1.
Well, it's just not the case. Chimp studies proved a long time ago that Homo sapiens isn't the only reasoning animal. Among others, they share that talent with elephants and dolphins. And as we've heard, Alex the avian was no bird brain. But cephalopods, I mean, they've been wafting through the waters for more than 500 million years, before sharks even. We left them behind a long time ago.
But with time, we've come to realize how smart our ancient cousins are. And it's not despite their brain size. Cephalopods have surprisingly big brains for their body size. And now research by Roger Hanlon has shown how they put all those neurons to use. His work at Woods Hole Marine Biological Laboratory in Massachusetts has shown that cuttlefish have uncanny abilities for camouflage and communication. Really? Okay, Roger. So if you were a cuttlefish and a predator swam by, how would you protect yourself?
I would protect myself with the most sophisticated skin evolved on this planet. These animals have the ability to swiftly view the visual scene and turn on one of several camouflage patterns within a single second. So it's this marvelous system that the cuttlefish have evolved, so to speak, and it seems to work extremely well.
Well, a lot of animals use camouflage. I mean, even zebras, in a sense, are camouflage, but they can't switch them quite as quickly. What about chameleons? People are familiar with chameleons. Are they in the same category?
No, chameleons, I'm afraid, are quite boring by comparison to a squid, an octopus, or a cuttlefish, and I'm not completely biased on that. You can time it, and you can see how the systems work. A chameleon responds for changing its heat absorption from the sun or to stay cooler or for fighting or attracting a mate, but they change slowly on the order of many seconds or minutes. The cuttlefish will change in an eye blink and can produce many patterns. So I'm afraid that the old chameleon is a little overstated in the textbooks, and the real kings of camouflage and color change are these cuttlefish and octopus.
Now, you say they camouflage themselves, presumably if they're swimming over an ocean bottom that has a certain texture and appearance, they might change to match that, but why don't they just simply do that automatically? Why do they wait for the predator to swim by before they perform this camouflage act?
Well, they don't wait for a predator to swim by. They stay camouflaged most of the time. So there's a misconception about that. In fact, what these animals do is they stay camouflaged almost all of the time, except when they really have to move or do something that is not possible to camouflage. So, for example, cuttlefish or an octopus will forage around a reef. It'll move very, very slowly with great stealth, and it will change its camouflage pattern every time it moves to another tiny little spot that requires a fine-tuning of the camouflage for that little microhabitat. So it's a very dynamic thing. It can't be just a reflex. They have to assess the visual background, and they have to make the adjustments sort of on the fly, if you will, and that takes a lot of brain processing power.
Well, what sort of physiology do they have that allows them to do this? I mean, I can think about my environment all I want, but my skin's going to look pretty much the same no matter where I am. How can they do it?
The physiology is pretty interesting and complex. First, it takes a good sensor, that is, an eye that can view the background and get the information needed, and then it takes a big brain to make the decision and to assimilate those visual information, and then it has to implement the right pattern in the skin. So the physiology is quite sophisticated, and the important item here is that everything is done through the nervous system. We have nervous systems to make things happen fast. If we want a slow color change, we do it through the blood with hormones. So this animal group has developed the great eye and the good brain and nervous system to make this pattern change fast.
I thought I read somewhere that, in fact, they don't actually have vision that allows them to see themselves. Presumably they can see, their environment, but they're not actually looking at what they've done to match the environment, or am I wrong about that?
There are two oddities about their ability to camouflage. One is that they have beautifully color-coordinated patterns for camouflage. However, they are not able to perceive color. In other words, they're performing colorblind camouflage. And that's still a mystery to us how they do that. Second of all, it's not a visual feedback loop, which means they don't look at the background and look at the back of their body and compare the two. They can't even see the back of their body. So they are looking at the background, and they're putting the right thing into their skin pattern, but they can't match the two visually.
Well, Roger, would you say this ability, which, to listen to you, it sounds somewhat unparalleled in the animal world, correct me if I'm wrong on that, but, this seems very clever. Would you regard the cuttlefish as being intelligent animals?
This ability of adaptive coloration, whether it's for camouflage or signaling and communication, is unique in the animal kingdom and gives these animals a capability that we don't see anywhere else throughout the animal kingdom. How they use it requires a large brain and very good sense organs like good eyes and amazing smart skin, if you will. And yes, I do think this translates to a certain kind of intelligence. This is something that no other animal can do, cannot do it as quickly or with as great a diversification. So I consider that a supreme adaptation to a very difficult problem of having a soft, mushy, tasty body, but developing this elaborate, sophisticated skin to evade all these visual predators.
Well, if I can press you a little bit on that, I mean, there are occasionally flies in this room here, and, you know, if I go after them, boy, they can escape fast, but it never occurs to me to call them intelligent, right? It's not some sort of adaptive behavior. If I do something completely different, you know, they don't rise to the occasion, as it were. They're just good at some things, and maybe the cuttlefish are just good at blending in. I mean, is it really intelligence?
I think it is intelligence in the following sense. One of the things they do that is particularly intriguing is called the moving rock trick. And this is combining camouflage with motion and movement. That's a very difficult thing to do because predators can pick up motion. Our eyes are tuned to things that move. And so they have to do an unusual trick. So an octopus on a coral reef is moving along slowly, staying camouflaged on corals and rocks, but then it has to eventually cross an open area where it's highly vulnerable. What the octopuses do is they puff their body up in the shape of a piece of coral or a rock, and they put on just the right camouflage pattern. And then they sort of, without moving most of their body, just on their tippy toes, if you will inch along the bottom. So they're moving, but they adjust their movement to the speed of the false movement in the visual scene, which is caused by the ripple of sun and the waves in the light field underwater. So this is much more than a reflex. This animal is assessing the visual field, how fast things are moving, what pattern to put on, and then they're adjusting all of that as they go along. And on a different day or 5 minutes later, if a cloud comes over, the wind stops, and you don't get that play of light in the water, they slow down and they go extremely slow and they do something else. So they're always, quote, thinking, unquote, about what the right maneuver is next, given the changing conditions. And that's the kind of thing that takes a lot of thinking and cogitating and decision-making that's on the fly. So yes, I call that a very important form of intelligence.
Well, you mentioned something else about them that does strike me as a marker of intelligence. You said that they communicate with other cuttlefish. How do they do that? They don't talk. How does one cuttlefish get in touch with another?
Well, they use this adaptive coloration for communication, and one particularly interesting example, a squid can be giving one signal from one side of its body and a different signal on the other side of its body, something humans would love to be able to do.
Well, I know people who try, at least with both sides of their mouths.
Well, exactly. So we talk out of our mouth two different ways. You can see a cuttlefish or a squid doing the same thing. So when a squid is courting a female, he keeps sort of the courtship pattern always facing towards her, but when approaching rival males come from the other side, he puts a totally different pattern on that side, which is an aggressive fighting pattern that says stay away. Now, if the female sees that aggressive pattern, she takes off and he wasted a lot of time courting her. So when she switches places, as soon as she's on the other side of him, he quickly changes his pattern to keep the courtship pattern on her side and the aggressive pattern away from her. That is a very sophisticated, on-the-fly kind of communication.
I would say, changing your tune, that's remarkable. And are these messages at all picked up by any other creatures in the sea, or are they just, you know, this is strictly cuttlefish to cuttlefish?
No, they have some signals that are cuttlefish to cuttlefish, and they have others that are cuttlefish to predators, and they even have signals cuttlefish to crabs that they eat. So sometimes they will orient towards a crab out in the open, and then they'll put on this dramatic display of these passing clouds of dark chromatophore bands rolling over the body of the cuttlefish in a high, rapid sequence. And this seems to mesmerize the crab and make it slow down or stop. And just as the crab stops for a moment, the cuttlefish then shoots out its two lightning-fast tentacles and grabs it and eats it. So here you have communication to confuse a potential food item.
Well, that's rather interesting because this is the evolution of intelligence. on the basis of a kind of a predator-prey relationship. Now, that sounds like the kind of evolutionary mechanism you might expect anywhere, not just on Earth, for that matter.
I think you're absolutely right. That is how sophisticated systems get developed, by trial and error, and we call that natural selection. And it's a common refrain on this planet. There's no reason to think that this isn't happening in other living systems and other planets in different galaxies.
So when people say, look, there may be lots of planets with life out there, of course I hear this a lot, but intelligence, now that's just an evolutionary accident that happened here on Earth, otherwise we wouldn't be having this conversation, but you shouldn't expect it to have happened anywhere else. Do you have any thought on that?
I disagree with that line of thought. Life is going to evolve, and as it evolves, it's going to change over time. It's going to react to these different environmental changes, and sooner or later, these forms will advance and change, or they will extinguish and they'll be gone. So that's life as we understand it. And until we discover life of very different forms, I think we can justifiably say that life is going to grow and evolve and other systems elsewhere, and we might find very different life forms subjected to different pressures. I find that very interesting, but in any case, you would expect the increasing complexity to form different kinds of intelligence, and it's up to us to try and understand what the nature of that intelligence might be.
All right. Well, Roger Hanlon, thank you for a very intelligent discussion with me today.
It was my pleasure. I really enjoy talking about these subjects, and it's a pleasure to try to enjoy the sophistication of nature.
Roger Hanlon is a senior scientist at Woods Hole Marine Biological Laboratory in Massachusetts. And if you'd like to see a video of a cuttlefish doing its cuttlefish thing, go to our blog on our website, radio.seti.org.
Coming up, why be brainy when you can be big and simply stomp out the competition like Godzilla? New research on evolution supersizing.
It's Are We Alone? Okay, so we've learned that brains have adaptive value in evolution and that there are different kinds of intelligence.
It pays to be smart, whether you're a parrot, a simian, or Homo sapiens. But not all creatures elected to grow their IQs. Some animals just decided to grow all over. New research by Stanford University scientist Jonathan Payne says that creatures got bigger over the course of evolutionary history in two leaps, two growth spurts, if you will.
Which raises a question, why be brainy if you can be brawny?
Well, first, let's figure out how we got brawny. And to think big, we first have to think small. Imagine it's the early Earth, 2.5 billion years ago.
Back then, the most prominent species to populate the planet were cyanobacteria, also known as blue-green algae. These single-celled organisms cooked up their own food through photosynthesis, just like your living room ficus. They sucked up carbon dioxide and water, churned it into sugar, and, this is key, spewed out oxygen.
This wave of oxygen allowed these single-celled life forms to become more energetic, using the high-test gas to increase their metabolism. They evolved from simple prokaryote cells to more complex life forms starting 1.6 billion years ago.
The first jump in maximum size occurred when eukaryotic cells first appeared. So these are cells like our own that have a discrete nucleus as well as some other internal structures called organelles.
Eukaryotes took oxygen as their main source of energy for the first time, and some became a million times more massive than anything that came before them. But there was more. A second boost in Earth's oxygen about 500 million years ago. Life grew enormously larger still.
The second jump in maximum size occurred when these eukaryotic cells figured out how to live together. Our bodies are made up of a bunch of these eukaryotic cells, which are then in turn differentiated so that our liver cells don't look like our brain cells or our skin cells. And so there's a subdivision of tasks.
And this specialized assembly of cells required oxygen to be distributed throughout the organism. That paved the way for greater complexity and for intelligent thinking species. But we put the question to Jonathan Payne. Suppose we didn't have oxygen in the atmosphere during those early years, would complexity, would intelligence have developed?
The fossil record on Earth suggests that the answer is probably no. Oxygen provides much more energy per oxygen atom than does any other source of energy. And so there are prokaryotes that use things like sulfate and nitrate ions in seawater to try to obtain energy. And they do that very successfully and have been doing it for billions of years. But the energy yield from oxygen is much greater, and that seems to be what helped to fuel the rise of eukaryotes.
So, Jonathan, increased levels of oxygen certainly permitted these bigger critters. And, you know, intelligence seems to be something that big creatures develop, whereas the very tiny ones don't. But on the other hand, what about the evolutionary benefit of being intelligent? I mean, it seems to me that if you just keep getting bigger, then you can always eat your competition. You're harder to eat yourselves. It seems to me that that might be a better strategy from nature's point of view. Just get bigger. Why did we get smarter?
So becoming smarter allows you to be more efficient in some ways in terms of extracting resources from the environment. If you can remember exactly where you need to go to get something, or you can figure out a new source of energy. And for example, humans have been extremely successful on that front. You know, some people would say too successful, that we've figured out how to obtain energy from things like coal and oil, which are buried dead organic matter from millions to hundreds of millions of years ago. We've also figured out how to obtain energy from nuclear reactions, which yield much more energy per unit mass than anything that we can do with more traditional chemistry. And of course, we're the only organism on Earth that can do anything like that.
Yeah, I don't notice those eukaryotes building nuclear power plants. At least they're very secretive about it. Now, oxygen levels in the past, I mean, they rose about 2 billion years ago, but they've occasionally gone down a little bit. They go up a little bit. At least this is what the geological record suggests. When the oxygen levels went back down, did animals get smaller, or did they get, you know, less clever or something?
What our record suggests is that at least over the last 600 million years, where we have a better record of what oxygen levels were, there hasn't really been any identifiable downward trend in the overall maximum size. If we look at particular groups of organisms, though, there are some hints that this is going on. For example, we think that the highest oxygen levels were reached during the Carboniferous period, so about 300 to 350 million years ago. And at that time, we see much larger arthropods or insects than we've seen on land at any other time in Earth history, suggesting that perhaps they were limited by oxygen levels at that time.
How big did those insects get, the biggest of them? I'm just curious how big a swatter I need to buy.
You'll need a big swatter. The largest dragonflies or dragonfly relatives appear to have had wingspans on the order of 2 feet or so. And the largest millipedes were about 6 feet long and about 6 inches across. So.
Yeah, if you found that in your bedroom, you'd probably want to turn down the oxygen levels. If you had to sort of look into the deep future here, Jonathan, you know, all right, we've gone from, the prokaryotes, eukaryotes, multicellular organisms. Now we have humankind, mucking up the planet or doing whatever we're doing. But what's the next stage in organization for nature, do you think?
I don't see things changing terribly much, at least in the amount of future that I can envision. One of the reasons I think that is that when we look at the planet today, we have one species, namely us, that is intelligent and socially organized and is using an enormous fraction of the resources on the planet. And so there certainly isn't room for more than one species behaving the way we are. We may be reaching the kind of carrying capacity that our planet can have, at least in terms of intelligence and resource use.
Finally, Jonathan, the rise of oxygen on this planet that has led to the kind of critters we see in the zoo and that we see in our own neighborhoods, my neighbors, for example. I mean, that was occasioned by the fact that there were these, little blue-green algae, I think they call them cyanobacteria now, but anyhow, billions of years ago that, exuded oxygen as a waste gas. And maybe that was just a biological accident. If we take a thousand planets out there in space with life, do you think that many of them are going to have oxygen-enriched atmospheres and maybe produce something as clever as we are?
One of the things we do see in evolution on Earth is that there's often convergence on good solutions. And so if we look at things like animals that are predators, often we see that they end up with teeth that are well adapted to cutting and ripping through meat, whereas if we look at plant eaters, they have teeth that are well adapted to grinding up and chewing up plant matter. And what that suggests is that if we have the same chemistry on another planet, meaning we have liquid water oceans, then I wouldn't be terribly surprised if another organism figured out how to generate oxygen as a byproduct of photosynthesis, because it turns out to be such an effective way to photosynthesize.
So you're optimistic about this. You're somewhat suggesting that if we could somehow rocket off to another planet where we've heard a signal from ET, for example, that we might be able to breathe their atmosphere.
Yes. What I think is that the chemistry of obtaining energy from the environment is reasonably well understood, and at least in my mind, it's easy to imagine that the same kinds of chemical tricks that organisms on Earth have figured out are probably the kinds of chemical tricks that life would figure out on other planets as well.
Jonathan Payne, thank you very much for talking to me. By the way, I'm working on my own growth spurt here now. I seem to be increasing in size too.
I hope that's vertically and not horizontally.
Spherical symmetry on the way.
Jonathan Payne is an assistant professor of geological and environmental science at Stanford University.
Finally, we arrive at human intelligence. That's what it's all about, right? Homo sapiens sapiens, the pinnacle of it all. Well, it turns out, after all those millions of years of evolution,
our brains barely work. Kludge, the haphazard construction of the human mind, is New York University psychologist Gary Marcus' explanation for this. Kludge, by the way, is no compliment. It's a piece of hardware that is clumsy and inefficient, yet it seems to do the job, if just barely.
I think that every one of us, for example, has pretty lousy memory. So even today, you probably had things that you wanted to remember that you can't remember. Maybe now you can't remember what the things were that you wanted to remember that you can't. But I think it's a safe bet that every time, every day, we go through life, we find things that we wish that we could remember that we couldn't. Now, to make you do something on the spot that you can't remember, I could ask you, like, what did you have for breakfast yesterday? And you probably would have trouble remembering it, because one of the hallmarks of human memory that I think is not sound evolution is that our memories blur together. So in a computer, every record that is stored, every piece of information is separate, and they don't blend together or blur together. But you can't remember what you had for breakfast yesterday because it's similar to what you had the day before and the day before that. You don't have such careful control over specific memories. And that's kind of a hallmark of the human being, that what we remember is sort of a bunch of similar memories that meet some criteria rather than the specific things we need to know at a particular moment.
Well, have we evolved that way simply to save space on the assumption that, well, remembering all those breakfasts really isn't going to help us in whatever life situation we find tomorrow? Is it just a matter of survival? You've got a finite brain. Some things are going to be blurry. Other things are going to be sharp.
Well, I think it's actually not a matter of how many things get stored, but how well we are or how good we are at retrieving them. So we actually store a ton of information. If I give you just the right set of clues, you can pull out almost anything. In general, the problem in the human mind is not laying down the memory traces, but getting them back out. So it's an organizational problem.
So retrieval is my problem.
Retrieval is really the problem. And the problem is that retrieval isn't organized by the specific spot that something's stored, but just by a bunch of cues. And the problem with using a bunch of cues is they can be ambiguous and you wind up with multiple answers. You try to remember where your keys are. What you tend to remember is where you usually put your keys rather than the last place that you put your keys.
Well, one example you cite that may indicate that our brains are less than optimally designed is that we apparently are constructed to respond immediately to situations, but not necessarily very accurately. I mean, why would we do this? Is it just better to have any answer, even if it's wrong?
Well, I think that we have both short-term oriented systems and long-term oriented systems. And the short-term oriented systems are tuned towards giving you some kind of answer right away. I mean, fight or flight, it's, you know, if the lion's coming at you, you can't stand there for 3 hours weighing the relative cost benefits. Well, I could go up the tree, but might be stuck there for a long time. You just got to act. And so a lot of our systems are tuned towards that immediate action. And the problem with that is that most of the kind of dilemmas that we face in the modern world aren't really like that. And so we're still tuned towards making these snap decisions, but we often have longer-term decisions that could maybe benefit from more reflection, which means, like, when you see the chocolate cake, the first thing that occurs to you, eat the chocolate cake, may outweigh the second thing that you might have thought of, which would be, maybe I'm going to have to go to the gym a lot more if I do that.
Now, it's kind of distressing, Gary, to note that the number of design flaws in our brains are really legion. I mean, our memories are weak. We're not logically consistent. We make choices that aren't necessarily in our best interest. Is all of this simply a consequence of the history here, of the haphazard construction of the human mind?
Well, that's the thesis of the book, is that a lot of these kind of design flaws in the human mind owe something to evolutionary history and to accident. In particular, there's what I call evolutionary inertia. And the idea is that evolution, once it's in a particular direction, tends to stay, continue in that direction. You can think about your human spine as an example of this. It's an adaptation of the spinal column system that you find in a four-legged creature, which makes a lot of sense there. There you have a horizontal column, and it distributes the load sort of like a picnic bench, and so it's able to hold up a lot of weight. But you change it in a human, you rotate it 90 degrees, and now you have a vertical column, and that's more like a flagpole. So basically, we have a flagpole holding up 70% of our body weight. It's not a good design. It's just that from an evolutionary perspective, it's kind of a cheap design. Not that many genes had to change. Instead of starting over and giving us three columns or four columns and shock absorbers or something like that, evolution kind of took the easy way out.
So you're almost saying we barely work.
It's like rubber bands and baling wire. I mean, our minds work reasonably well. It's much better than not having a mind at all, but it doesn't mean that it's perfect. In terms of what you're talking about in today's show, I would say that in a lot of ways the human mind is sort of at the top of the mountain, but it's maybe on top of a mountain, not the top of the highest mountain. So we do a lot of things better than any competing creature on the planet, but that doesn't mean that we do them perfectly or that 50 years from now or 1,000 years from now, suddenly we wouldn't be able to design a better brain that would work more efficiently than the one that we've got.
Well, okay. Can I take satisfaction then in the fact that other critters on this planet aren't necessarily any better engineered than we are? I mean, you don't get that impression. And people talk about the eyesight of a hawk or how fast a cheetah can run. And, you can point to all these various capabilities of other animals, and they seem to outstrip us in at least some. Are we any better or worse than,
I don't know if there's an easy answer to that. So a lot of creatures are very well engineered to narrow environments, and they do what they do very well. So the hawk is very good at catching its prey. We're able to do a much broader range of things, but because we evolved so recently, there are a lot of glitches in those things. So, like, we can do philosophy and scientific reasoning. We don't typically do it very well unless we get a lot of training, but at least we can do it at all. There's no sort of simple answer. It really depends, what particular thing are you talking about? Can people do it well? Can animals do it well? There's no magic where we're really absolutely at the ultimate possible.
Well, that leads inevitably to the big question. People say that we only use 10% of our brain. I've heard that contested. I assume that we use all of our brain, but even using it all isn't very good, right?
Well, there's actually a mild truth to that old rumor, but it's not quite the way that people think about it. So when you say we only use 10% of the brain, it makes it sound like 90% is wasted. But what it really means is that any particular thing that you do in one moment tends to draw on maybe 10% of the brain. The way that the brain works, actually, is it switches different pieces on and off, and it's pretty good at doing that. So you get some stimulus, and part of what the brain has to do when you see a picture or hear a sound or whatever is to say, what part of the brain is appropriate for trying to figure out what this is about and what I can do next? And the way that the brain does that is basically by switching different pieces on and off. So it probably is true that you use something like 10% of your brain at any given moment. All of it gets used in the course of a day.
All right. Well, good enough. Now, here's where I was really going, though. Since we are really a compromised thinking system, the result of happenstance and selection and contingency and all those words that are used in evolutionary biology, what do you see as the future, Gary, now that we're beginning to understand this stuff at the biochemical level? Are we going to be able to improve the design here? Are the brains of our ancestors going to get better?
I would hope that we'll be patient enough to wait to do that until we really know what we're doing. So I think there are lots of risks with things like genetic engineering because they say it's only 25,000 genes and it's not that many, but it's like a play with 25,000 actors. It's very complicated the way all of the genes interact. Eventually, when we really get a handle on that, I do think that we'll be able to improve things. Someday, when we have good enough machines and a good enough understanding of biology and of neuroscience, there's no reason in principle why we couldn't make brains that work better than ours. Ours aren't perfect, and there's room for improvement.
All right. Well, Gary Marcus, from one faulty brain to another, thank you very much for talking with me.
Thanks for having me.
Gary Marcus is a psychologist at New York University and the author of Kluge, The Haphazard Construction of the Human Mind.
That's it for our show. Now, let's test your intelligence, Seth. I have a quiz that they use at Mensa schools all over the world. I'm quite sure of it. Okay, you ready?
Yeah, I guess so.
To whom do we owe gratitude on this program?
Barbara Vance, Gary Niederhoff, and Emmanuel Romero.
And?
The SETI Institute.
And?
The NASA Astrobiology Institute.
Okay, what's NASA stand for?
The National Air and Space Administration.
And how can people get in touch with Are We Alone?
Write to us at arewealone@seti.org or check out our blog, Facebook, or our Facebook fan page.
Which is used for?
Allows listeners to discuss topics heard on the show.
The gray-faced Sengi is native to what country?
Tanzania, most commonly sighted in the Udzungwa Mountains.
And what's the first question I asked you in this quiz?
To whom do we owe gratitude?
No, it was okay. But you've actually done very well. You're highly evolved, Seth.
Oh, thanks.
And who's this guy taking over your microphone?
I have no idea.
Support for Are We Alone provided by Sun Microsystems, the creator of Java, who invites you to visit java.com and learn more about how Java technology is powering the planet's digital future.